this a little closer to you because you're a little, I tend to be loud.
Hi, welcome to Infill, where we discuss local San Francisco politics and policy. Today we are in Supervisor Tang's office in City Hall. Thank you so much for making time for us today, Supervisor Tang.
Thank you for having me. Hello, everyone.
So Supervisor Tang is the supervisor of District 4, which is one of our outlying neighborhoods. If you know where Golden Gate Park is, it's sort of just south of that. Do you want to talk a little bit about your district and kind of what the different neighborhoods and kind of quality is out there?
Sure. So we have a lot of residential homes out there, single family homes mostly. We are west of 19th Avenue and, you know, basically we've got folks living out there, lots of families, some of the highest population of children and seniors in our district. So long time, you know, many generational families out there.
Cool. So those would not always be framed as the most pro-housing of the groups of San Francisco.
No, not at all. No, no.
So I guess a lot of us were really impressed and surprised when you really took the lead proposing this density bonus legislation, now known as Home SF, that's doing a version of the state density bonus law for the local San Francisco. So talk to us some about that. Give us like a good overview intro.
Sure. So I worked on Home SF for a couple of years now with planning department staff and really trying to incentivize the building of more affordable housing specifically for our middle class, middle income working families. As you all know, our city really has invested nothing in terms of housing for our workforce families. And so this is a, you know, a version of the state density bonus law that really strives to achieve that. You know, we have so many families moving out of San Francisco. You all know that. And so, you know, really our goal is to, over the span of 20 years, create 5,000 permanently affordable housing units, again, for our middle-income workforce families. And over the course of 20 years, in combination of market and affordable, would be 16,000 affordable units. So, 16,000 total units. So, you know, as you may or may not know, the program applies to non-RH1 and non-RH2. So anything above three or more units, area plans are excluded. We have a requirement for 30% on-site affordable housing. And if you meet that requirement, then you get additional two stories above existing height limits. So that's an incentive there. Also, we require 40% of the units to be two bedrooms or more. Or you have an option of producing 50% of units with two or three bedroom mix. And a couple of things that we do put in our legislation to just ensure that, you know, our community members feel good about this is that there's no displacement of existing residential tenants or demolition, removal, or conversion of existing residential uses. It does require CU for any projects undergoing the Home SF program.
And that's conditional use permit.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. No, conditional use permit.
Make sure we...
We also prohibit the merging of lots that results in more than 125 feet in lot frontage in neighborhood commercial districts. Many people are afraid of these monster developments happening, so we understood that. And then, of course, there's a concern around small business displacement, right, on the ground floor. And so we do have a provision in here that requires that a developer, if you are displacing a business, that you replace the ground floor square footage with like size, so that it really, you know, in essence, prevents a formula retail size business from coming in and replacing a small mom and pop shop type situation. So we also require that the units be broken down into three different tiers of income levels, both for renters and for ownership. So under the rental BMR below market rate units, the income levels would be offered at 55% of the area median income, 80% AMI, and 110% AMI. And we could talk a little bit later about what those income levels are and what are some of the job classifications that are associated with it. And then for ownership, affordable units would be offered at 90%, 120%, and 140% AMI. So this was to really address the fact that some folks wanted to make sure there was an even distribution, you know, among the various income levels. So this was the best way we could try to do that. And of course, we're always encouraging family-friendly amenities in buildings. So, for example, us encouraging maybe the inclusion of three bedroom units in the mix, distributing larger units on all floors, trying to get them to be closer to open spaces and play yards. And then think about some other family-friendly amenities within the unit, such as a bathtub. Or within the building, considering stroller or storage space, or having your building located very close to open space and yards. So that's kind of a nutshell where the program is today, and it is pending in our Land Use Committee at the Board of Supervisors, probably for about a, you know, until the end of April or so. And you know, we're happy to continue discussing the details with the rest of the city, but certainly, you know, I know folks are concerned about height limit increases, and
not our folks.
Yeah, not your folks, but maybe some of my district residents. But you know, when we looked at the analysis as to where these projects would even qualify for Home SF, and remember this is an optional program, right? So most of those sites are actually located along transit and commercial corridors, and I think that's where we should be focusing our building on. And this program, you know, really targets that, and so I think it's a great alternative to the state density bonus law that's in existence.
Yeah. So we've talked some about the state density bonus in the past where, you know, basically if you do a certain percentage subsidized affordable, you can go an extra two stories.
Actually, you know, at the state level, there is no cap on the height increases. As long, whatever you need to achieve your 35% density increase, you get that height. So you could be, I think, like Berkeley and try to, you know, build these buildings with these massive courtyards and go up really high to achieve your 35% additional density.
Sounds
right?
So lovely.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, who doesn't love a beautiful courtyard building? I think this is, you know, a lot of these buildings sound really cool, but of course in San Francisco, you know, they're seen as, you know, monstrous and terrifying as opposed to
right.
homes for families
right.
and singles. But you know, you really sort of, when you first came out with a local version of the state density bonus law, it took a lot of heat. I think we watched a lot of people, you know, frankly, lie about what was in the mm-hmm. program and pretend that there was no state density
exactly.
bonus.
Exactly. There was huge denial that the state density bonus law applied and that developers in San Francisco could even use it. And now I think in this past year where you've seen the Board of Supervisors and the Planning Commission and Department all approve, you know, our first project under the state law, I think reality set in. And I really hope that that has shown people that we should have an alternative version, a local version that reflects what we care about here in San Francisco. And again, I keep having to remind people it's an optional program. So, you know, there are folks who could certainly come along and develop under, you know, a code conforming project, a code compliant one under state law, or, you know, just not use any of these density bonuses at all.
Yeah, I think a lot of our people are still a little bit split on, you know, the amount of work that's been put into the local state density bonus, the local version of the bonus law, versus like just encouraging every developer to really just hammer through a state density bonus. And so could you talk to, so people who are in a pro-housing, pro-building housing mindset, what the benefits of passing a local version of the state law really are?
I think that the benefits of the local version are that, you know, we actually have higher affordability requirements, so 30% on site, right? And again, this is very much targeted at our middle income families, which is, you know, if you care about preserving our families here in San Francisco, then this is really, we hope, the product for it. But I mean, also, I think, you know, the fact that we don't allow for displacement of existing residential uses, I mean, it says a lot about our San Francisco values, right? And so I think that, you know, this is a program that planning department spent a lot of time developing to ensure that we're addressing as many concerns as possible. So when you compare it against the state law, actually you can get more units out of a local program while still achieving all those other things that we're asking developers to do. So at the end of the day, you know, for example, I have heard of people waiting for this program because they compared the state and the local, and it actually in many cases works out better to go with a local program.
And one of the arguments that I've heard is that you know, San Francisco, we like to consider ourselves a very wonderful, special snowflake. And that, you know, the planning department and the planning commissioners and the whole process is biased towards liking local laws. And therefore, those projects will move faster through the pipeline than projects that are trying to use state law. Do you think that's a compelling argument?
You know, I cannot speak for the department, but because the planning staff works so hard on this Home SF program, I would imagine that they would like to see some uptake on, you know, through this program. So, you know, certainly we hope that, you know, we think it'll achieve a goal that currently isn't being met in other ways. So, you know, without saying as much as guaranteeing that that would happen, right. You know, certainly the desire is there. Yeah.
A lot of people, I think, are rightly seeing that this is kind of the first stab at upzoning the west side and the south side, you know, in ever. You know, that this amounts to an upzoning, which is really exciting for the YIMBYs who are saying, okay, we're going to, like, actually admit that we need to be building more housing. You know, yes, it's only on transit corridors, which we're pro-transit. There should be transit mm-hmm. corridors everywhere in the city. We should be doing more for transit so mm-hmm. that there are no non-transit corridors, but that's a side issue.
Yeah.
You know, I think that this does... The rebellion that we saw from West Side homeowners last time who were, you know, putting up flyers mm-hmm. that had, you know, pictures of San Francisco with a bomb targeting system on it and said, whose neighborhood is next? You know,
yeah.
was pretty extreme.
It is extreme because when you look at a map of where even the projects would qualify under Home SF and then you remove the parcels where there's existing residential uses, you really, I mean, for example, in the Sunset District, you eliminate probably, and something you probably don't want to hear, but you eliminate about 85 to 90% of the district. So you're left with these like four corridors where you could really build something. And I think, you know, yes, it is an upzoning if you do apply for a project under this program, but I'm okay with that as long as it's along a transit corridor, right? And I think that when you talk to a lot of San Franciscans, especially those living on the west side of the city, you find that they want all the amenities and features of a suburban neighborhood while living in a dense urban environment, right? And that doesn't really work. So, you know, certainly I know that in the west side maybe was not as attractive to live in before, and so the people who are now living there in their single family homes, many of them maybe detached, enjoy that atmosphere. But you know, for me personally, I want to welcome more people to San Francisco. I want them to have that same wonderful opportunity that my parents and I had living here, growing up here. And, you know, I'm not ready to shut out people from the city. There might be residents who have their homes who are ready to do that. I'm not ready to do that.
That's awesome. What would you say to people who, you know, are in that mindset of protect my neighborhood? I think that, you know, your message of inclusion is one that resonates a lot with the YIMBYs. And I haven't seen it resonate a lot with, you know, some of the, you know, I mean, I sort of call them anti-housing activists, but, you know, people who are very invested in, you know, what they see as protecting an idyllic lifestyle that you're describing to them. You know, what kinds of sort of, I'm sure you're going to a lot of community meetings. So what's that kind of like?
I hear a lot of people talk about the preservation of neighborhood character. And certainly everyone has their own ideas about what that means. But we also have to remember that when you talk about neighborhood characteristic, it's a snapshot in time. So the Mission, for example, was one way maybe 50 years ago, and now is a different atmosphere. Which characteristic are we talking about, right? And so, you know, for me, I can agree that sure, you know, at least on the west side of town, most people want to preserve their single family homes and don't want to see high rises everywhere. They don't want to see towers on the beach, right? I get that. And that's not something we're trying to do. We are actually trying to be very careful and rather surgical about where we actually want to have the housing being produced. And you really just, I'm sorry, I can't understand when people argue against building more density along transit corridors. That is absolutely where development should happen. So, you know, again, I think people should be very mindful of what they mean by neighborhood characteristic. And, you know, with all the talk about, you know, at the federal level, you know, the discourse there and how we should all be welcoming of all people of different communities, I sometimes don't see people practicing that in real life when it comes to, you know, I don't want development in my building or in my neighborhood, right? So, you know, there's this a little bit of a divide there, you know, in reality. So we're hoping to at least get this program forward so that people see it's probably not as scary as you think. In fact, I wish it could even be more aggressive.
Yeah, development is people. So breaking into the, you know, percentage AMIs, I know that that's a big focus for a lot of the legislators right now. I think the YIMBYs are a little bit hesitant about saying that we're going to be building a lot of subsidized middle-income housing. We have, in general, been a little quite skeptical, I guess, that, you know, there's no way that we're going to build, like Hong Kong, enough subsidized housing for all the middle-income people who need it, that really we need to be building a lot more housing in order to make market-rate housing affordable to middle-income people. But I know this has been a big focus of the program for you. So I guess I kind of want to open it up to, like, you fleshing out what these AMIs mean and what you feel like it's symbolically achieving in the bill.
I think that, you know, we talk a lot about, for example, preserving our teachers and our basic workers here in San Francisco. And I think people haven't realized over time just how much our cost of living has gone up and how much these people are actually making. So for example, if we take a look at even the lowest level, the 55% AMI for rental units, right? That would be around what a postal clerk makes in San Francisco. Let's go to ownership, where we have at the lowest tier 90% of the area median income as a qualifying unit. And that would be somewhere between what an accountant and an electrical engineer might make here. And, you know, if you look
at those people should be living in market rate housing. You know, I mean, this is like the hard thing. I mean, they can't right now.
They can't. But they can't. And so then you look at even an elementary and secondary school teacher. They're making about 90% of the area median income as well. And so that would be someone who could qualify under the lowest rung tier for ownership BMR unit and would be right around the middle and higher end of rental units. Post-secondary teachers make around 100% AMI, you know, around $68,000 on average. And then even if you look at police, fire, and ambulance dispatch, they're around 110% of AMI, which is the highest rung for rental BMR units. So, you know, I think that over time, people have forgotten just, again, how expensive it is to live in San Francisco, and that, you know, these folks, whether it's housekeeping cleaners, landscape workers, construction workers, teachers, accountants, these are the people who can't stay in San Francisco. And I think absolutely we need to build market rate housing. We need to build low and very low income housing, but we also need something in the middle. And frankly, the market hasn't really produced much of that lately, or at least forced this requirement for certain income levels to achieve the, you know, the preservation of our middle class families. So that's something that I really hope we can achieve through this Home SF program.
I mean, I love it purely because it's an upzoning, you know, and I think most of our people, you know, I understand there's a lot of bells and whistles that got added into this legislation mm-hmm. as it was moving its way through the various committees. But I think, you know, we see it as still holding, you know, the core, which is, you know, adding more units on transit corridors in areas that haven't seen an upzoning. Mm-hmm. You were at the hearing, I think, right on teacher housing recently that went on and on and on.
I heard about this hearing, yes.
you know, that was a big focus on the shortage of teacher housing and mm-hmm. everyone's emotional reactions to that, which I think are really important to hear from. But one thing that was interesting in that, or a couple things. One is no one was really talking about how that fit in with pieces of legislation that are already moving their way through.
Exactly. People are ignoring the fact that Home SF could be one piece of the puzzle for solving the teacher housing crisis.
Two, you had people saying stop building housing in order to have more teacher housing, which was like, oh,
that does not make
so
sense
painful.
To me.
Yeah. And then you had people who were saying we should be building, you know, teacher housing, like building housing for teachers on teacher, on
teacher
property.
Campuses, especially. Yeah. Yes. Which I've heard some teachers actually refer to as teacher quote unquote ghettos. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it sounds great on paper, but some teachers do not want to live with their colleagues. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think that, any ideas around teacher housing specifically on school district property needs to have, you know, include a kind of diverse community of professions, I mean, within a school community. So maybe that means college professors even, or paraprofessionals, maybe early care and education providers, right? So, you know, I think there needs to be some sort of, again, diversity in professions and throughout which types of schools too.
But I think they're right that there's a lot of property owned by the city that, whether it's teacher housing or other kind of housing, you know, could have a lot more housing on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that the school district is finally exploring some opportunities around that. And it's going to be kind of their first foray into developing some sort of teacher housing mix or development. And I think that's really important for us to think about if it's really a priority for us. But I think, again, I don't want people to ignore the fact that we do have policies in place or that are being considered, such as Home SF, that are seeking to house teachers in particular.
Awesome. So for people, you know, in your district or also across the city, what are the ways that they can like help push this legislation forward and make sure that we're able to pass this and you know, hopefully, you know, pass bigger and better legislation that's going to spur more housing production in the future?
I think it's really important that if you care about this issue and you want to provide more housing for people in San Francisco, that please do contact your district supervisor and let them know that you want them to support Home SF. And we don't have a hearing date set yet for Land Use Committee, but stay tuned maybe around end of April or early May. And, you know, of course, you know, go out on social media or write blog posts or what have you. I think it's really important that we hear from more people who want to support having more people live in San Francisco.
Yeah. I mean, I think I see it in City Hall every day. You know, the squeaky wheel gets the oil in San
Absolutely.
Francisco.
Absolutely. And I think that we're, you know, although we're talking about this local program, we also have to remember that at the state level, you know, there's certainly some efforts, not just in San Francisco, but throughout the entire state where people want to dismantle the state density bonus law. And so I think that if that were to occur, it is so important then for us to have a version that is local and that, again, reflects what we want to see here in San Francisco.
Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much, Kay. This has been awesome.
Thank you for having me.